Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, and in this case, it's Sergei Plekhanov, someone I've had known for decades, ever since I went to the old Soviet Union to write about it for the Los Angeles Times, where I was a journalist, and he was the co-director, or well, I forget the exact title, but
deputy
director, thank you, Sergei, of a very famous institute in the old Soviet Union, famous because it was probably the most independent institute of its kind, a scholarly institute for the Center for the Study of USA and Canada. And because they were studying these other places and being relied on quite heavily, they had to have a lot of freedom of travel and movement and conversation. So we attended a lot of conferences. I did in the Soviet Union, but also we had them in California and elsewhere in the United States. And Sergei went on to become a Canadian and a Canadian professor, where he is now at the York University. And he is the author of a major study on the whole history of Russian, U.S., Canadian relations. And that's why we're here to talk about it. It's a low point in the post-Cold War period. Maybe not a low point with Donald Trump coming in, because he says he can get along with Vladimir Putin. Let's begin right there, Sergei. What's going on? Are we going into a new Cold War? Is Donald Trump naive about Putin? And how did this all go south so fast?
We had 25 years after the negotiated end of the Cold War, more than 25 years, in fact. Because, you know, it was Reagan and Gorbachev, the leaders of the two superpowers, who pretty much officially declared the Cold War over in 1988. And a few people expected
that was at their meeting in Reykjavik. Were you there, or were you
a part? Oh, no. The meeting in Reykjavik was in 86.
Yeah.
But by 1988, they had signed an unprecedented treaty that eliminated a whole class of nuclear weapons, medium, intermediate range, which were deployed in Europe, and that was a major breakthrough. And then Reagan came to Moscow, and he declared the Cold War over. Both of them would say, hey, you know, this is the end of the Cold War. They negotiated a grand bargain, and few people expected that. By the way, when Reagan came to power in 1980, people were expecting that not only there would be a resumption of the Cold War, but that we might have a real nuclear war. Last fall, September, October of last year, we were on the brink of the first ever real military war between Russia and the United States over Syria. And it had to do with whether or not the United States should declare the no-fly zone over Syria. President Obama was pondering over this issue, and there were powerful people around him who were pushing him to declare that zone. And Hillary Clinton was openly calling exactly for this on campaign trail. Now, he thought about that, and Obama and you know, discussed it with his military guys, and they said, well, okay, let's do so, but we must be ready to wage war on Syria and Russia.
How do we get to this mess now? You mentioned Hillary Clinton and the hawks on the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton's a memoir of her years in the State Department clearly positioned her into a more hawkish position than Barack Obama. And she defended the intervention in the Middle East and militarily with Libya, with Syria, and so forth. And you know, Barack Obama resisted some of that advice. But there was real concern in this election. Yes, there's a lot of concern about Trump being president, but someone like myself had concern about Hillary coming in and bringing us back to a neoconservative, hawkish position. What is your assessment?
Another Cold War, called Cold War II, has already started. I think you can make caveats and say, well, not really, it's a different, but something like a Cold War confrontation, complete with a policy in place in the United States government and in NATO of containment of Russia. This is now official policy of the United States and its allies, containment of Russia, because Russia is accused of being aggressive expansionists. Hillary has accused Putin of trying to rebuild the Soviet Union, and she vowed never to let that happen. And Russia is to be is being punished by sanctions for its actions in Ukraine and in Syria. And now there's a new cause, and that is accusations that Russia was meddling in the American election by hacking. So Russia, from the point of view of, I would say, most influential people in the foreign policy establishment of the United States, Russia has behaved as a violator, or Russia has undermined the international order. And so Russia needs to be punished. It needs to be contained. That's the view.
James Clapper, the head of National Intelligence, who famously lied to the Senate Intelligence Committee and when he said Snowden was wrong and that they were not spying on American people or any of this extensive spying, nonetheless, just recently said that Russia represents an existential threat to the United States, meaning we're back at the worst moments of the Cold War, where we are up against what he's describing as a superpower who can destroy life here. Now, they can because they have a lot of nuclear weapons, but the irony of the current situation is that we do have still a communist power in China. It's still run by a communist party. There's still an ideology. Putin is not any longer a communist, if he ever really in his heart was. He was with the KGB. You know much more about his history than I ever will know. But it's ironic that Putin, who has embraced the Russian Orthodox Church, who has embraced crony capitalism, has embraced the worst excesses of a market economy in many ways, is now still thought of as somehow he is the red menace. We have a new McCarthyism blasting anyone in this country who might be sympathetic to him. And the irony is that he is not. There is a communist party still in Russia, and that's actually his opposition, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It has the support of about 20% of people. But you see, it's not about communism or lack thereof, crony capitalism. It's about Russia. Russia is the biggest state in the world, and its territory includes most of the Eurasian heartland. It has more neighbors than any other country, 13, including the United States, China, Norway, Poland, what have you, Turkey. And the thing is that for the West, for a few centuries, ever since Russia began to grow and became an empire, this transcontinental giant state, which is both in Europe and in Asia, Europe has felt intimidated, concerned, trying to either resist Russia or control Russia. Russia is too big. So containment of Russia, when Russia becomes too strong, it needs to be contained. That's been the Western view, the often again, on again. Napoleon did that. The Germans did that. The Swedes tried to contain Russia, fighting against Peter the Great and so on. Hitler wanted to completely enslave Russia. In the Cold War, containment of Russia was only partly about communism. It was more importantly about the geopolitical weight, heft of Russia, which is tremendous. So now that Russia, if Russia remains big but is totally subordinate to the United States, I mean, doing everything that the United States would prefer and not daring to challenge the will of the United States, then it's okay. But a Russia that becomes disobedient sends a signal to other states, you know, and it is China, it's Iran, it's any country, countries in Africa. You know, if you can be disobedient to the will of the hegemon, which is the United States, the indispensable nation, the special nation, the most influential power in the world, the guarantor of the world order, Russia is too big to be allowed to be disobedient. It really becomes a challenge to the world order. The problem with the old order, such as there is that it's falling apart not because of Russia, but because of the decay of the dominant ideology of that order. The neoliberal world order has entered into a stage where it is falling apart and it needs to be reformed. And ironically, the best idea for the reform of the world order has come from the right wing of the Republican Party, from this maverick billionaire, Trump, who says, hey, you know, I think that we should negotiate with other great powers, all kinds of deals. And that's actually smart because the United States has just shown that it cannot run the world. Hillary believes that it can. And we saw how dangerous that could be. I mean, just look at the record of U.S. policy in the Middle East. It's a complete disaster, unmitigated disaster. But of course, it's convenient to blame it all on Putin. You know, Putin is responsible. Putin is actually now has become the excuse for all kinds of blunders in foreign policy for anyone who wants to be. Just blame Putin and people will nod their heads, say, yeah. But that exaggerates the power of Russia tremendously. It's scapegoating, and it's stupid in terms of foreign policy making, because fundamentally there's no conflict between the national interests of Russia and the United States. Well, that's it takes somebody like Trump to recognize that in the face of the entire foreign policy establishment of the United States. He said, we need to contain Russia. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Try to contain Russia and see what happens.
Okay, but now, hopefully, you know, from your lips to God's ear, Trump turns out to actually have a serious and consistent thought about this and is actually interested in negotiating in a serious way with Putin. But the conventional wisdom, which you have violated now in the last 10 minutes, asserts that, no, Putin is the new menace. As I said, James Clapper, this guy who lied to the Senate, actually said that Russia is an existential threat to the existence of the United States and its democracy. That's an incredibly sweeping statement that's being treated with great dignity. Joseph Biden said, how dare Trump insult the intelligence community and attack them for that. The convention, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they all are on the side. And their assessment is Putin, in addition to Trump being the new menace, Putin is the new menace. Now, I know you as a person who, Sergei Plekhanov, a professor at York University, to be very sensitive about the excesses of government power. You lived under the old Soviet Union, but even in the worst days, I always found you to be a person who had deep respect for the notion of limited government, of individual rights and freedoms, and so forth. You have a deep understanding of the great things about the Western experience and the American experience. You're even a lover of country western and folk music and so forth. So you know all about the tradition of struggle. And what I really want to get from you is the insight of someone who really, who grew up and studied and got his advanced degrees, doctorate and everything in Russia. And tell me, what is going on? Is Putin popular? Is he another Hitler? Is he a demagogue? Is he Mussolini? Who is Putin?
He's neither a Hitler or Mussolini. He is a conservative. He is a strong leader of Russia, which has been transitioning from the failed model of state socialism or communism that they tried to reform. We tried to reform, and it didn't work. So Russia found itself in a kind of a limbo, and Putin is concerned first and foremost about the viability, survivability of Russia as a country, as a state. Putin is indeed a very popular Russian leader, and that's not because the Russian people don't know what the hell is going on. In terms of knowing about every little and big trouble in countries such as corruption, kleptocracy, poor performance of the economy, the Russians are informed. When I hear somebody like Vice President Biden confidently telling the television audience, I think it was on CNN, oh, I'll explain to you, he says, everything about Russia. 90% of Russians, that's according to Biden, 90% of Russia get their news from the three news channels, television channels, and they're all controlled by the Kremlin. No further explanations required. When I watched that, I couldn't just believe my eyes. I said, Joe, who is advising you? Where do you get this crap? Do you know that 60 million Russians get their daily news from the internet? And the internet is free. But even if they don't get the internet, they listen to the FM radio, and the biggest FM station, which is called Echo of Moscow, is run by the liberals, and it's independent of the Kremlin. And the kind of stuff that they put on the air, and they broadcast 24 hours a day, and they heard all over the time zone, 11 time zones of Russia from east to west. The kinds of things that they say about Putin, about Ukraine, I mean, that would, the American news media pales into insignificance compared to the criticism. So the Russians are informed, and they
will
know.
Well,
what I'm saying is that for now they say, okay, for now Putin is the best bet we have, and he's doing a reasonably good job. But that doesn't mean that.
Okay, but
I mean, there's no personality cult. They're very pragmatic about this.
Well, this is Sheer Intelligence. We're going to take a break now and have more of Sergei Plekhanov when we come back. This is Robert Sheer with Sheer Intelligence, and my guest is Sergei Plekhanov for the second half of this discussion. I get your insight about what the West is all about and their hostility to, you know, the whole need for hegemony and everything, particularly by the Americans. But what is your view? Is Putin the good czar? Does he really have support? And if so, why? And why hasn't a more democratic, responsive alternative developed?
Well, first of all, the thing is that Putin and Putinism is a transitional phase of Russia's evolution toward a viable politico-economic order with less inequality, with true democracy, with transparent government. Can you have both security and democracy? Well, ideally you can, but in real terms, when Russia is pushed around, when you come to a point like the one that I discussed before that we reached last fall when we were on the brink of war, understandably enough, the Russians are more concerned about security and they're prepared to accept a heavier government, a more centralized government, which spends more time, more resources on defense and security and so on, than they would otherwise have. In the 1990s, they didn't expect that there would be another Cold War. They didn't feel that they were being threatened by the West or contained by the West. But now there is this sense. And of course, the big difference between the Cold War now, there's this new Cold War, And the original one was that today the world is multipolar. You know, back in late 1940s, China was a country which was in ruins after decades of civil war, Japanese occupation, and so on and so forth. Now China is the biggest economy in the world, which is growing faster than any other. And Russia is aligning with China. They're very close. They're almost allies. On most issues, they think alike, and more importantly, they're building transcontinental projects of economic development, which are so interesting, so attractive. Now, this is a big threat. If the Russians and the Chinese finance the construction of a transcontinental communication corridor across Eurasia, which would allow somebody living in London to jump into his or her car and then drive across Russia all the way to the Bering Strait and then use the brand new bridge across the Bering Strait and arrive in Alaska and then travel on to San Francisco. This is what they're talking about. I mean, that's a big threat.
So you're not talking about internet communication. You're talking about physical.
No.
Trucks going
everything.
On highways.
No. Railroads, pipelines, highways, and lots of cities on the way, new cities which will be built. Because Siberia is ripe for development. And we're talking about the development of the infrastructure, economic infrastructure of Eurasia. This is the main thing in Eurasia. It's not really containing Russia by means of putting a few hundred Marines in Estonia is beyond ridiculous. Because Russia, okay, you push the Russia from the West, you lose big bucks from the denial, from disruption of normal economic activity as a result of sanctions. Okay, Russia will grow in the East because the East is growing. The West is stagnant. Asia is rising, and the biggest part of Russia is in Asia. So Russia has rediscovered Asia. And in Asia, the Russians are welcome. The Japanese, who have been hostile to the Russians because of a few small islands, are now keen to negotiate a deal on those islands because they want big contracts. They want to be part of this big Eurasian growth, this transformation of Eurasia that Russia and China are leading. Where does that put the United States? On the margins. So somebody like Trump, who thinks like a businessman, he says, hey, I really think that there are more opportunities than dangers with regard to Russia. So we're stuck in this obsolete policy of containment because because I don't know what. But in the meantime, we might actually benefit tremendously from being part of this larger network of economic ties and economic development that is growing in Eurasia.
The average person listening to this would ask, because of the way Russia has been described, would you have the freedom and the confidence to express your views in Russia? And your
Absolutely. And I listen, I read what Russian scholars, Russian politicians, Russian journalists have to say. And there is so much free discussion, free discourse, free exchange of information in Russia. You know, it's unprecedented. The degree of intellectual freedom in Russia is unprecedented in the 1,000 years of history of the Russian state. You know, you come to any bookstore and you look at what kind of books are available. Okay, let's pick a topic, the United States. All right, so you come to a shelf with hundreds of books on the United States. At one end, there are books which are charging that the United States is a predatory imperialist power which has a conspiracy to control the world and to destroy Russia. At the other end, there are books, translations of American texts like Henry Kissinger's books, Zbigniew Brzezinski's books, and other books. Hillary Clinton's memoirs, I think they're available in Russian. Go ahead and, you know, pick a book and read, then compare it with something else, with another book.
Okay, but what
and
about
the same on the topic of Putin, by the way.
I have a lot of respect for you because I know in the darkest days of the Soviet Union when I talked to you, you were an independent source for me. You had courage, you were brave, and you spoke the truth. And I'm talking about when you could have really been easily killed or eliminated. And you were a truly honest figure, and I know many journalists felt that way. You're also now a Canadian citizen, and I know you don't have to worry about, you know, what's going to happen to you in Russia. You're in Canada. But I'm saying what you're saying will be taken as naive by many people listening to this.
I know. Let me mention one thing. In the climate of vilification of Russia, demonization of Russia, a real Russophobia that exists in the West, any attempt to correct this imbalance, to present a more objective picture, makes you look like you are, in the words of Congressman Schiff, by the way, on Fox News, talking to Tucker Carlson. He said, Tucker Carlson, you're carrying water for the Kremlin, because Carlson was doubting that the Russians were meddling in the American. I mean, that's enough. You're carrying water for the Kremlin. Well, and I'm sure that some people would say, well, Sergei is just a propagandist for Putin. I, by the way, I've never voted for Putin as a Russian, and I'm not a Putin supporter. You know, I'm an academic who's trying to make sense of what's happening in the world, and I'm appalled at the quality of reporting on Russia, interpreting Russia, that dominates the media here in the West.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just appalled. It's worse than it was in the Cold War. You know, Steve Cohen, who is one of the renowned specialists on Russia in the United States, he keeps saying it's worse than the Cold War. He remembers the Cold War. And I do remember. I agree with him. It's worse than in the Cold War. Now, how come that, you know, 25 years after the Cold War, the truth about Russia has a harder time getting to the American people than during the Cold War? Something's wrong here.
Well, let me ask you about that. What you know, because we both know how terrible it was to have a free, independent view in the old Soviet Union. Even when Gorbachev came in, he did. He's the man who dismantled the system and deserves great credit. But I remember at that time, trying to get people to talk honestly. I remember even being with you at one conference where Sakharov was there, and it was, you know, you really wondered about his well-being and others. And you were one of the brave people that spoke up and would talk honestly about what was going on. So people ask right now, because they have been given an image of Putin's Russia, that they actually have just slipped in, you know, Congressman Schiff, who you mentioned, who's from Los Angeles, and, you know, he's the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. He has not offered any criticism of any of these intelligence agencies. He's the one who denounces Snowden and Julian Assange and everywhere. And he'll just say, oh, this is all propaganda. People can't speak up. They're afraid and so forth. So what, and you, as I say, are now a Canadian and you have independence. What's going on here? Are these people...
We are living through the times of propaganda warfare. And in propaganda warfare, anything goes. And in propaganda warfare, truth is the first victim. And truth is always complicated when you're talking about a country, especially a country as complex as Russia. I mean, if you ask me, is Russia a democracy? I say no. Is Russia evolving toward democracy? I would say, I hope so. Russia is a soft authoritarian state, which is very poorly governed, which is characterized by some of the world's highest degrees of economic inequality, enormous concentration of wealth in the hands of the few. And the government, is the government controlled by the people? Well, in some way, but actually this is a top-heavy government. But at the same time, Russia has a growing middle class. Russia has a market economy. Most of its economy is privately owned. And the public sphere in Russia teems with debate, discussion, information, and so on and so forth, which makes Russia a live thing. It's not a frozen thing. It's very much alive. It's dynamic. It's moving. It's evolving towards something. And I'd like the United States to recognize that and not to hurt that process, because when Russia is pushed around, when you begin to threaten Russia from the outside, then people rally around the government and they say, hey, we need bigger army, we need a bigger security service because we don't want... And people who are advocating closer relations with the United States may be traitors, maybe they are paid by the Americans, because this discourse, this Russophobic discourse in the United States is echoed, mirrored in a similar discourse in Russia. And these people are on the airwaves. These people are publishing their books. These people are members of Russian parliament, and so on and so forth. You know, when Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats, all those, opponents of the West were expecting that Putin would do likewise. And some went as far as say, target Obama personally. You know, find weak spots and target the top officials of the Obama administration. Instead, what Putin did, he said, I don't want to play these games. We're not expelling anyone. And that was a big disappointment, both in Russia, the hawks in Russia, and the hawks in the United States were, a bummer. We expected that it would be more tit for tat. Yeah, that's exactly what the military-industrial complexes need on both sides. You know, people who are producing weapons would like to have more money for those weapons. People running the military would like to have more money to have a bigger, more powerful military. And that works on both sides, both in the United States and in Russia.
So I want to conclude this by asking you your assessment as an expert, really, on U.S.-Soviet relations. We've had other hawkish people, other belligerent people come into office and so forth, and there have been some surprises. Nixon certainly did some of the first negotiations of detente and advocated it. He did the big opening to China. So now one of the figures who's been appointed Donald Trump is the former head of Exxon. And he's accused of having a seat somewhere on a business in Russia and so forth. How do you assess him?
I think it's a good idea to put a businessman in charge of the State Department. But apart from the personalities concerned, I think what Trump represents and the reason why, contrary to all expectations, by the way, in Moscow as well, few people expected Trump to win. And many in the Russian ruling elite would have preferred Clinton, because that's the devil you know. With Trump, it's a big jump into the big unknown. And whatever he says on the campaign trail might be overturned by the real politics of Washington. But there is an opportunity for a normalization of relations, because we have to recognize that the current state of U.S.-Russian relations is unacceptable for the world, because when the two nuclear giants begin to push each other around and come to the brink of war, what they're toying with is survival of the entire human race. You know, the two presidents, just think about President Putin and President Trump will have the opportunity to order a nuclear war in a bad crisis. And then when the missiles start flying, that's curtains for all of us. It's an intolerable, unacceptable degree of power to be held by any kind of a human or somebody from another planet. We are not supposed to be ruled like that. So the least that we can expect from these leaders is that they keep their differences at a level which does not threaten the world. And even better, make deals to make the world more stable and make the relationship between Russia and the United States safer for the world. My advice is think of how you can make U.S.-Russian relations safer for the world. And that involves talking about nuclear weapons. I don't think that Trump, this caricature, he'll be in the White House and he'll have, a fit of rage and he will push the button and the missiles start flying. I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I think there is, just as it was under Nixon, remember that was another conservative and warmonger and so on, under whom in 1971-72 we had a historic turn in international politics, our first attempt to bring the Cold War to an end, to bring and successful treaties to regulate nuclear weapons, to reduce the nuclear threat. Then another hawk, Reagan, under him, who promised to wage war on the big bad Soviet Union, we had the end of the Cold War, negotiated. And so those precedents, conservative Republicans thinking in terms of what is in the national interest of the United States and how we can make relations with Russia more predictable, stable, more normal, because that's in the national interest of both sides. And why can't the same thing be repeated under Trump?
I want to thank you for stating your views, and I don't think anyone listening to this, people would certainly hope you're right. We will see. But certainly when you're talking about those 14,000 nuclear weapons that the U.S. and Russia still have and are still on hair trigger alert, it commands attention. I want to thank you for doing this. I want to thank our producers, Joshua Shear and Rebecca Mooney, and our engineers at KCRW, Mario Diaz and Kat Yor. I want to thank the folks at Sports Byline who put this together, and Darren Peck and the Canadian National Broadcasting Company for making their facilities available, and Sergei Povkanov, a professor at York University. Thanks for doing this.